last night. She's a well-known actress. Rosina Vanbrugh, she was just visiting me. We hardly ever go to the theatre. She was just visiting me on business. I saw you on telly. Did you? What was it? I forget. I must go now, she repeated, and got up and retrieved her shopping bag. I felt panic. Hartley, don't go. You look, oh, so tired. This was not the best thing to say, but it expressed a sort of anguish of protectiveness and tenderness and pity, and a kind of humility which I felt about her then as I saw her standing there before me in the guise of an old woman. She did look tired. Tiredness was somehow the expression of her face. Not sadness or suffering, so much as a vast weariness, as of one who has worked too hard for years and years. I'm very well, apart from endless tummy trouble. You look well, Charles, and so young. I must go. She shuffled past me in the direction of the door. I leapt up and followed her. But what shall we do? Hartley looked at me as if she was not sure what this question meant. I repeated, what shall we do? I mean, oh, Hartley, Hartley, when shall I see you? Can we meet after you've done your shopping? Can we meet in the pub, or would you come down to my house? Vistas of madness opened beyond these words. Hartley opened the church door, pulling at it laboriously, and over her shoulder I could see Dummy's grave and the criss-cross iron gate, and the village street with people in it, and the far horizon line of the sea. I said wildly, "Of course I'll call on you. I'd so much like to meet your husband. You must both come down to my funny house and have a drink. You know I live—" "Yes, I know. Thank you, but not just now. My husband is not too well. But I'll see you. I must. What's your address? Which bungalow?" "It's called Niblets. It's the last one, but don't. I'll let you know. Please, Hartley, see me after you've done your shopping. Let me help you." "No, no, I'm late. Don't come. You stay here. I'll see you later. I mean, on another day. Please don't do anything. I'll let you know. I must run now. I'll let you know. Please stay here. Goodbye." I had wanted to touch her, but somehow only with my fingertips, as if she were a ghost which might dissolve. I had wanted to hold her dress between my fingers. Now I felt a more precise need to take her head and draw it quietly against me and hear her heart beating. Old desires were suddenly present. I saw her blue, blue eyes and the curious mad look of her round face which was so unchanged, and her lips which had been so white and so cold. I started to say, "I'm not on the telephone." She went quickly out of the church and closed the door carefully. Obeying her, I stayed. I went back to the same place and sat down, and once more put my hands where her hands had been. What was I going to do? How was I going to manage myself for the rest of my life, now that I had found Hartley again? Was I going to go round to Niblets once a week and have tea with Mr. and Mrs. Benjamin Fitch, or entertain them to beans and sausages and claret at Shrough End? Take them up to London for a show? Take an interest in Titus's future? Look after them all? Leave Titus my money? My mind leapt wildly about. Huge vistas opened. Immense areas of the future were suddenly live and quick with possibilities, all of them terrible. Ingenious, I thought. I must be ingenious. I looked at my watch. It was 10:20. So much awful thought in so little time. I sat for a while until I reckoned that Hartley would have done her shopping and gone back up the hill, and then emerged from the church and sat on Dummy's grave, leaning against the gravestone which bore the image of the foul anchor. From there I could see over some trees the roofs of the bungalows, including the last one, the residence of Mr. and Mrs. Fitch, a disabled travelling salesman. What was the matter with him? A cripple? I knew that I would have to go and take a look at Mr. Benjamin Fitch very soon. Why had Hartley been so reluctant? Why had she not said, "Yes, come and see us," or "We'd love to come and see you"? Sanity demanded such gestures, whatever she felt. Politeness demanded them, and by politeness one might, for the present at any rate, be saved. Or was the crippled husband really ill, suffering, peevish and bedridden, perhaps? But, oh, what did Hartley feel? What made her seem so strained and anxious? Her reluctance to invite me to her house was perhaps understandable, indeed very understandable. You are so grand and famous. She was perhaps a little bit ashamed of her house and her husband. That need not mean she did not love him. But did she love him? I had to know. Was she really happy? I had to know. And that old, horrible, sweetish thought now kept coming to me. She must regret it so much, that wrong choice. She must have spent her life regretting that she had not married me. I saw you on telly. What was that like? What mean, gnawing pains of remorse did she feel when she saw me as a celebrity? How could she know that I was still just me and that I still missed her? And must she not think of me as surrounded by attractive women, as probably possessing a permanent mistress? She had seen Rosina. She might have seen Lizzie. Perhaps, it suddenly occurred to me, and this was so painful and so sweetish, too, she is reluctant to see me precisely because of her regrets, remorse, jealousy, the waywardness of fruitless daydream. She does not want to know any more about what might have been. Oh, God, those years, our whole life that we might have spent together. She does not want to start to love me all over again. I already had enough instinct for dangerous thoughts to thrust this one aside. I was indeed, as I leaned back against the sun-warmed, lichen-spotted surface of Dummy's laconic monument, sketching a kind of programme for survival. Roughly, the programme was like this. There was no doubt that I must now somehow contrive to devote the rest of my life to Hartley. I quickly banished the idea that Mr. Fitch was seriously ill and would shortly die. This could only be done if I accepted their marriage, and could successfully attempt to construct a friendship with her, and presumably with him. Hartley and I were not just revisiting each other as tourists. That was out of the question. At the least, the husband must tolerate me. Perhaps I could be allowable as a figure of fun. I did not quite care for this, but so quick is imagination that I already heard Hartley saying to her spouse, "Why, there's dear old Charles again, he can't keep away," while she felt something a little different. Perhaps the husband might even be flattered that a show-business personality admired his wife. However, these were unsavoury, or at any rate, premature speculations. What I must now concentrate upon was the possibility of love in the form of a pure, deep, affectionate, mutual respect, a steady, constant, binding awareness. Of course, it would have to be, love between us, but love purged of possessive madness, purged of self, disciplined by time and the irrevocability of our fates. We must find out how at last to be absolutes to each other, never to lose each other without putting any foot wrong, or spilling one drop of some brimming vessel of truth and history which was held up austerely between us. "I will respect her. I will respect her," I kept saying to myself. I felt a tenderness for her that was deep and pure, a miracle of love preserved. How clear it flowed, that fountain from the far past. Yes, we must quietly collect our past, collect it up with tacit understanding, without any intensity or drama, blaming and exonerating ourselves with a difference. And how wonderfully possible it seemed, this silent process of redemption, as I rethought our passionate, yet gentle and divinely inept little conversation in the church. Was that what it was like, meeting the great love of one's life again after all those years? And had we not been for each other the shy, direct, innocent creatures we had once been? The nature of our converse had never been spoilt, and in that blundering conversation its note could unmistakably be heard again. Perhaps I would indeed, through her and through our old childish love, now irremediably chaste, be enabled to become what I had hoped to become when I came away to the sea, pure in heart. The question, is she a widow, already seemed to belong to the remote past, to some vanished and entirely obsolete method of thinking. The question, which was now, in spite of the programme for rational survival with which I was consoling myself, in danger of becoming agonisingly urgent, was, is she happy? To decide this, it was necessary to inspect Mr. Fitch, and moreover it was quite impossible to wait. As I walked slowly back to Shrough End, I thought, I have got to see Mr. Fitch today. I will call on them about 6 o'clock this evening. It was not until I was actually ringing the bell at Niblett's that it occurred to me to wonder whether in all those years Hartley had ever actually told him anything about me at all. Niblett's is a small, square bungalow built of a red brick which has been partly and mercifully whitewashed. Without compromise, it squats upon the hill with a group of wind-tormented trees opposite to it, beside it the slope to the village, behind it the slope to the sea, beyond and above it, woodland. It has a firm, solid air. Other houses might be built upon sand, or even be made of sand, but not so Niblett's. The bricks are unchipped, sharp, and uneroded at the corners. There is no moss upon the roof, and one feels that none will ever grow there. An equally undimmed, red-tiled path leads to the front door between beds of spiky little rose bushes in their first flowering. A fuzzy mass of white clematis, growing up one of the wooden posts of the porch, soothes with some grace the blue front door which is covered with very thick, very shiny paint. The door has an oval panel of opaque, frosted glass which seems to creep before the eyes. Niblett's is not a charmless house. It is pretty and homey, with its discreet, patchy whitewash and its bright, flower-fringed door. Within there are four main rooms, the sitting-room and kitchen-dining-room being both at the back, where a descending lawn is overwhelmed by the view of the sea. But I anticipate. The day had become hot. The temperature had risen to 80 degrees in the afternoon, and the air was still shimmering with heat. From the hillside one could see the distant headlands of the Bay Couchant in a light brownish heat haze. The vast bowl of the sea was glowing a very pale blue, with silvery mirages and streaks of light. The crowded roses were hotly odorous. The bell, which I rang just as I suddenly thought that perhaps Mr. Fitch was unaware that I knew his wife, and that this accounted for her panic, was penetratingly sweet, like a tuning fork struck for a choir of angels. Low voices were at once heard within. Then, after a moment, Hartley opened the door. I got the shock again of her changed appearance, since in my intense and cherishing thought she had become young again, before I saw on her face a look of fear, which instantly vanished. Then I could see nothing but her large eyes, seeming violet and somehow glazed and veiled as if they were looking beyond me. I could feel myself blushing, the accursed red wave surging up through my neck and face. I had deliberately prepared nothing to say. I said, "Oh, excuse me. I was passing by, returning from a walk, and I just thought I'd call in for a moment." I had time before she replied to think, I ought to have let her speak first. Then if she had indeed never told her husband about me, she could pretend I was selling brushes. I was wearing my jeans with a clean white shirt and my faded but decent cotton jacket. I tried to look into her eyes, but it was impossible, and the fear, or whatever it was, had gone. She said nothing to me, but turned to speak back into the house. It sounded like, "It's him." As she spoke, she swung the door back, half closing it in my face, and for a moment I thought she was simply going to shut it. There was the sound of an ejaculation within, perhaps just, "Oh." The door swung open again, and Hartley was smiling at me. "Do come in for a minute." I wiped my feet on the large, clean, bristly orange mat and stepped into the hall, blinded by the change of light. All the way from Shrough End, and indeed all day since my resolve to call on Hartley, I had been feeling sick with excitement. Sick with a blend of obscure bodily agitation and clarified fear, not unlike, only this was much worse, what I used to feel when I dived off very high boards in California to impress Fritzy. I could not now see Hartley properly in the sudden darkness of the interior, but I felt her presence as a violent, diffused magnetism which somehow pervaded the whole house, as if Hartley were the house, and as if I had been swept into a cavern where she embraced me and I could not touch her. Indeed, the impossibility of touching her made my whole body shake with a kind of negative electricity. At the same time, I was sickeningly conscious of the invisible husband. I had vividly imagined and reimagined beforehand the moment of arrival, ringing the bell, meeting Mr. Fitch, and this had seemed in anticipation like a dive into the unknown, indeed into the irrevocable. Only now it was proving an agonizingly slow dive, as if the water towards which I was moving was receding, leaving me falling slowly through the air. Hartley actually left me standing in the hall and went back into a room for a whispered consultation, almost closing the door. The hall was tiny. I was now conscious of an altar-like table with a rose bowl, and above it a large brown print of a medieval knight. Hartley emerged and threw open another door, ushering me into an empty room which proved to be the sitting room. She said, "I'm so sorry. We're in the middle of our tea. We'll join you in a moment." Then she left me again, closing the door. I realized now how dangerously I had acted and how foolish I had been. 6 o'clock, for me, meant drinks. I had imagined it would be a sensible and humane time to call. In fact, I had interrupted their evening meal. To beguile the frightful interval, I looked round the room. A large bow window with a big, semicircular, white-painted window ledge gave a partial view of the village and a full view of the harbour and the sea. A pair of expensive-looking field glasses lay on the ledge beside a massive bowl of roses. The sea was shining into the room like an enamelled mirror with its own especial clear light. This light excited and upset me, and dazzled me so that now I could scarcely see my surroundings. There was a thick carpet underfoot, and the room was hot and stuffy, and smelt excessively of roses. Hartley came in, followed by her husband. In my first dazzled view of him, Fitch looked grossly boyish. He was rather short and thick-set, and had a bullet-headed boy's look, with a thick neck and short, mousy hair. He had very dark, brown, narrow eyes, a rather large, clear-cut, sensual mouth, and a prominent, shiny nose with broad, flaring nostrils. He was broad-shouldered and powerful-looking. If he was crippled, it certainly did not show. He came in smiling. I beamed, blinking a little, and we spontaneously shook hands. "Glad to meet you. I hope you didn't mind my calling."
"Not at all."
Hartley, who had been wearing something blue, perhaps an overall, when she opened the door, was now revealed in a yellow cotton dress with a tight bodice and a big skirt. She moved nervously about, not looking at me.
"Oh, dear, I must open a window. How stuffy this room is. Won't you sit down?"
I sat down in, or got stuck into, a tubby, velvety, low-slung armchair. Hartley said to Fitch,
"Shall we bring our meal in here?"
He said, "Why not?" Hartley went back into the kitchen, where they had evidently been eating, and returned with 2 plates, while Fitch pulled a gate-legged table out from the wall and set it up, rather uncertainly, upon the thick carpet. Hartley then handed the 2 plates to Fitch, who stood holding them while she fussed, looking for table mats to put them on. The 2 plates, with their knives and forks upon them, were then put down. A plate of bread or something was fetched, upright chairs were pulled across the resistant carpet, and Hartley and Fitch sat down. Their chairs half turned, so as to accommodate me. They had been eating ham and salad, but it was now immediately clear that further eating had become impossible. Hartley said to me,
"Would you like anything to eat?"
"Oh, no thanks. I only called for a moment.
I'm terribly sorry. I see I've interrupted your—"
"Not at all." Fitch said nothing, but looked at me with his dark, narrow eyes, flaring out his nostrils into 2 great holes. His big mouth in repose looked rather forbidding. Surprise, or perhaps a flurried annoyance, seemed to have deprived them of the power of conversing, so I floundered quickly to get something going. I had decided to depart after the very briefest possible polite interchange. "What a lovely view you have."
"Yes, isn't it? We got the house for the view, really."
"My house just looks on the rocks and the sea. It's nice for swimming, though. Do you swim much?"
"No, Ben can't swim."
"I like your big window. You can see all round."
"Yes, it's nice, isn't it?"
she added.
"It's our dream house."
"Have you got electricity?"
asked Fitch, who had hitherto been silent. I rated this as a definitely friendly remark.
"No. You have, haven't you? That must be a blessing. I get along with oil lamps and caligas." "Got a car?"
"No. Have you?"
"No." What brought you to this part of the world?
Well, no special reason. A friend of mine described it to me. She grew up near here, and I wanted to retire near the sea, and houses are cheaper here than they aren't all that cheap, said Fitch.
All this, while my visible surroundings were, now that I was accustomed to the light, imprinting themselves upon me with the sharpness and authority of a picture. I was conscious of my awkwardly outstretched legs, my still flushed face, my fast heartbeat, the stuffy rose-scented air to which the open window seemed to have made no difference, and the fact that I felt at a disadvantage in a low chair. I took in the brown and yellow floral design on the carpet, the light brown wallpaper, the shiny ochre tiles round the electric fire which was set in the wall. Two round brass bas-reliefs representing churches hung on either side of the fire. A funny-looking shaggy rug upon the carpet was making extra difficulties for one of the table legs. There was a large television set, with more roses on top of it. No books. The room was very clean and tidy, so perhaps, except for watching television, life went on in the kitchen. The one sign of habitation was, on one of the chairs, a glossy mail-order catalogue and an ashtray with a pipe in it. At the table, Hartley and Fitch were sitting stiff and upright, like a married pair rendered by a primitive painter. There was something especially primitive about the clear outlines and well-defined surfaces of Fitch's eccentric and not altogether unpleasing face. Hartley's face was, perhaps just in my timid, fugitive vision of it, hazier, restless, a soft moon of whiteness with hidden eyes. I was able to look only at her flowing yellow dress, round-necked, rather resembling a nightdress, and patterned all over with tiny brown flowers. Fitch was wearing a shabby light blue suit, jacket and trousers with a thin brown stripe. Braces were visible through the unbuttoned jacket, which he had probably pulled on when I was announced. His blue shirt was clean. Hartley patted down, then plumped up, the waves of her grey hair. I felt sick with emotion and embarrassment and shame and a desire to get away and assess what all this was doing to me. "Have you lived here long?"
2 years, said Fitch.
Still settling in, really? Said Hartley.
We saw you on television, said Fitch.
Mary was thrilled.
She remembered you.
Yes, of course. She remembered me from school, of course.
We don't know any celebrities. Quite a thrill, eh?
To get off this loathsome subject, I said, is your son still at school?
Our son? Said Fitch.
No, he's left school, said Hartley.
He's adopted, you know, said Fitch.
Earlier on they had been fiddling now and then with their forks, pretending to be about to eat. Now they had laid them down.
They were looking, not at me, but at the carpet near my feet.
Fitch shot an occasional glance at me. I decided it was time to go.
Well, it's very kind of you to let me call. I must be off now. I'm so sorry I interrupted your meal. I do hope you'll come over and visit me soon. Are you on the telephone?
Yes, but it's out of order, said Fitch.
Hartley had risen hastily. I got up and tripped over the shaggy rug.
What a nice rug.
Yes, said Hartley. It's a rag rug.
A rag rug. Ben makes them.
She opened the sitting-room door. Fitch got up more slowly, and as he now moved, standing aside to wave me out of the room, I saw that he limped. He said,
You go first. I've got a gammy leg. Old war wound.
I said as I went through the dim hall towards the glaring brightness of the oval glass on the door,
Well, we must be in touch, mustn't we? I do hope you'll both come over and have a drink and see my funny house, and
Hartley swung the front door open.
Goodbye. Thanks for calling,
said Fitch. I was on the red-tiled path, and the door had closed. As soon as I was out of sight, I began to run. I reached the village street panting, and began to walk more slowly along the footpath which led to the coast road. As I walked, I began to have a weird, uncomfortable sensation in my back, which, amid all the wild emotions and sensations which were rushing about inside me, I could identify as the sensation of being observed. I was about to turn round when it came to me that I was now well inside the span of the Niblet's view, and within range of Fitch's powerful field glasses, should he care to sit on the window ledge and check on my departure. Parts of the village street were plainly visible from Niblet, though the church and the churchyard were hidden by trees. So was that the explanation of Hartley's uneasiness? Her thought that perhaps Fitch had actually seen me meet her and lead her away towards the church. She had, I remembered, walked behind me, not with me. How odd it must have looked, though, with me as a crazed Orpheus and her as a dazed Eurydice. Yet why should she be afraid of being seen to meet somebody, even me, in the street? Resisting the present temptation to look back, I walked smartly on and was soon among the stunted trees and gorse bushes and rocky outcrops near to the road, and out of sight from the hill. It was still very hot. I pulled off my jacket. It was soaked under the arms with dark stains of anxious perspiration, and the dye had stained my shirt. I then began to wonder many things, some very immediate, others vastly remote and metaphysical. First, there was the question I had so belatedly asked myself when I was ringing the bell. Evidently Hartley had told her husband that she knew me. But when and how, and indeed why, had she told him? Years and years ago, when she first met him? After they got married? When they saw me on the telly? Or even when she got home this morning from our meeting in the street? Oh, I just met someone I used to know, such a surprise. And she might then recall their having seen me on television. But no, this was too elaborate. She must have told him much earlier. After all, why on earth not? Did I want her to have kept me a secret, as indeed I had so devotedly kept her a secret? Why had I done so? Because she was something holy, which almost any speech would profane. Insofar as I had ever mentioned Hartley to anyone, I had always regretted it. No one understood. No one could understand. Better the austere sterility of silence. One of the horrors of marriage is that the partners are supposed to tell each other everything. It's him. They had obviously been talking about me today. I just hated the idea that through all those years they could have chattered about me, dismissed me, demeaned it all, chewed it all up into some sort of digestible matrimonial pabulum. "Your schoolboy admirer has done well for himself." Fitch called her Mary. Well, that was her name, too. But Hartley was her real name. In choosing to abandon it, had she deliberately abandoned her past? When I got home, although it was still very light outside, the house seemed dark, and by contrast with the sunshine, cool and damp. I poured myself some sherry and bitters and took it out onto my little rock-surrounded lawn at the back and sat on the rug which I had placed upon the rock seat beside the trough where I put the stones. But it was at once intolerable not to see the water, so I climbed up a bit, gingerly holding my glass, and sat on top of a rock. The sea was now a bluish purple, the colour of Hartley's eyes. Oh, God, what was I to make of it all? Whatever happened, I must try not to suffer. But in order for me not to suffer, two incompatible states of affairs had to exist. I had to achieve a steady, permanent, and somehow close relationship with Hartley, and I had to avoid entering a hell of jealousy. Also, of course, I must not disturb her marriage. And yet why, of course? No, I could not, would not think of disturbing her marriage. It would be unthinkably immoral to try, and there was no reason to imagine that I would necessarily succeed if I did try. That way madness lay. I did not, looking at that pair, imagine that the glamour of a celebrity would be much to conjure with. This made me think of how Hartley looked. That slightly vague, fey look she had always had of looking past one. I had sometimes allowed myself the luxury of brooding upon her remorse. Perhaps she had felt remorse. But now, the person I had loved, and loved now, was not likely to be stupidly dazzled by a reputation. So if I was searching for cracks in the fabric... Well, of course I was not doing that. I was just trying to understand. I could make little on reflection of Le Mari. I had expected, I now realized, an insignificant little man. I had doubtless required and wanted an insignificant little man. But Fitch was somehow, I could not quite think why, not insignificant. What was he like? What went on inside the sealed container of this marriage? And would I ever know? I could not help at least feeling rather pleased that Titus was adopted. All this led me back to the now somehow central question, is she happy?
Of course, I knew enough about the mystery of marriage to be aware that this may be a frivolous question to ask about a married person. People may be settled into ways of life which preclude continued happiness, but which are satisfactory and far to be preferred to alternatives. A small number of married couples are increasingly pleased with each other and radiate happiness. Sydney and Rosemary Ash radiated happiness. There was certainly no such radiation up at Niblett's. Though, of course, I must take into account the unease caused by my sudden appearance. There had been an awkwardness, the cause of which was obscure. And surely, if they had been very happy together, they would both instinctively have wanted to show off this happiness to the intruding outsider. A happy couple cannot help showing off. Sydney and Rosemary did it all the time. So did Victor and Julia. And yet this was inconclusive. What was plain, and this indeed was the thought which prevented the awful pain from beginning, was that I must soon see Hartley again, alone if possible, and get some clearer picture of the situation. As the sun began to go down and the sea was turning gold under a very pale green sky, I laid my empty glass in a cranny and crawled up to a higher rock from which I could get a view of the whole expanse of water. In the lurid yet uncertain light, I found that I was now suddenly scanning the scene and watching it intently. What was I looking for? I was looking for that sea monster. The next day, before 9 o'clock, I was entering the church. I'd reached it by a roundabout route, first climbing over the rocks on the other side of the road, then veering away through the gorse in the direction of the Raven Hotel, crossing the bog on the seaward side of a Mourn farm, going through 3 fields and 3 prickly hedges, and approaching Narrowdean from inland, along the main road. By this method I did not at any point enter the Niblett's view. I tried not to feel sure that Hartley would come to the church. In any case, I decided that it was the only place where it was worth keeping a vigil, since it was more unlikely that she would walk out to Shrough End. Of course there was no one there, although someone had been in since yesterday and had put upon the altar a vast, odorous bowl of white roses which disturbed me with all sorts of deep, incoherent, unconceptualized apprehensions. Time had suffered a profound disturbance, and I could feel all sorts of dark debris from the far past shifting and beginning to move up towards the surface. I sat feeling sick and reading the 10 Commandments, which were almost illegibly inscribed upon a brown board behind the roses, and trying not to pay any special attention to the 10th and 7th, and trying not at every moment to expect Hartley. The bright sun was blazing in through the tall, rounded, leaded, faintly greenish glass windows of the church and making the big room, for that after all was all that it was, feel weird and uneasy. There was a good deal of dust about, moving idly and airily in the sunlight, and the smell of the roses mingled with the dust and with some old, musty, woody smell, and the place seemed unused and very empty and a little mad. It seemed a suitable spot for a strange, momentous interview. I felt frightened. Was I frightened of Fitch? I waited in the church for more than an hour. I walked up and down. I read all the memorial tablets carefully. I smelt the roses. I read pieces of the horrible new prayer book. No wonder the churches are empty. I inspected the embroidered hassocks wrought by the local ladies. I climbed onto the pews and looked out of the windows. I thought of poor Dummy lying out there in the churchyard, scarcely more speechless now than he ever was. At about 10:20 I decided that I had to get out into the air. It was all a great mistake, hiding in the church when Hartley might be walking openly about the streets. I wanted to see her so much that I was nearly moaning aloud. I ran out and went down through the iron gate and sat on a seat, where I could see quite a lot of the little high street, but without being visible from the hillside. After a few minutes I saw a woman who looked like Hartley, creeping along by the wall on the far side of the street, going in the direction of the shop. I say, creeping along, because that was part of my first vision of her as an old woman, before I knew who she was, and it was this old woman image that I was seeing now. I jumped up and set off after her. As she crossed the road she turned slightly and saw me, and increased her pace. It was Hartley, all right, and she was running away from me. She did not go into the shop, but whisked round into what I called Fisherman's Stores Street. When I reached the corner running, she was nowhere to be seen. I went into the Fisherman's Stores, but she was not there. I wanted to howl with exasperation. I ran along to the end of the street, where it petered out in a few derelict cottages and a five-barred gate, and a large meadow fringed by trees. She could not have crossed that meadow. Had she gone into one of the houses? I ran back. Then I saw a little alleyway leading off the street, a narrow, sunless fissure between the blank sides of two houses. I ran down it, stumbled over a strewing of pebbles, and turned a sharp corner into a square enclosed space between the low, whitewashed walls of backyards, where there were a number of overflowing dustbins and old cardboard boxes, and an abandoned bicycle. And there, standing quite still in the middle of this scene, was Hartley. She was standing just behind a low outcrop of the sparkling yellow rock which surrounded my house. She looked at me out of a sort of resigned, trance-like calm, staring and unsmiling, and yet I could see that inwardly she was trembling like a quarry. The dark shadow of a wall fell across the yard, dividing the rock and somehow composing the picture, covering Hartley's feet as she stood there holding a basket and her handbag. She was wearing a blue cotton dress today with a closely packed design of white daisies, and a loose, baggy brown cardigan over it, although the day was already hot. I ran up to her and seized hold not of her arm, but of the handle of her shopping basket. This chase, this catch, had frightened us both. "Oh, Hartley, don't do it! Don't run away from me! It's mad! Thank God I found you! If I hadn't, I'd have gone crazy! I must talk to you. Come to the church, please." I pulled at the handle of the basket, and she walked in front of me down the narrow alley. "You go to the church. I'll follow you after I've shopped." "Yes, I promise." I went back to the church. After that chase, after that awful enclosed space with the dustbins and the rock and the bicycle, I, too, was trembling. She came in 10 minutes. I went to take her heavy basket from her. I simply did not know how to behave to her. There was some profound, awful barrier of what I felt as embarrassment, though it was also dread. If only some touch of grace could turn all this pain into communication and the gestures of love. But grace, in every sense, was lacking. I felt now a frantic desire to touch her, to hold her. But I could think of no way of achieving this, as if it would have been an amazing physical feat. We sat down where we had sat before, she in the pew in front, turning round to me. "Why did you hide? I can't bear this. We must somehow get a grip on this situation. I shall go mad. Charles, please don't be so... And please don't call round unexpectedly like that. I'm sorry, but I've got to see you. I still care about you. What do you expect me to do? At least we've got to be friends. Now we've got this chance to... this chance. Of course I won't do anything you don't want. Please. Look, couldn't you and your husband come round and see me? Come round for drinks tomorrow at 6? Well, at 5. At 7, any time that suits you. Come to funny old Shrough End. I want you to see the house. Why not?" Hartley was hunched up, her head shrunk into her neck, the rumpled collar of her blue dress cupping her hair. She was looking down, almost hidden by the pew. "Please don't expect anything of us. I mean, don't call on us or ask us to... We don't go to parties. It's not a party. It's not necessary for us to be like that, just because... And please don't run after me in the street. People will notice." "But you ran away from me. You hid where we live. People don't sort of entertain because they're neighbours. They keep themselves to themselves. But you already know me. And there needn't be any entertaining, if you mean ridiculous formalities. I hate that anyway. Hartley, I won't put up with this. Can't you just explain?" Hartley now looked at me properly. I noticed that today she was wearing no lipstick, and this helped me to read her young look into her old look. Her tired, pale, wrinkled, soft, round face now looked very sad, with a kind of resigned sadness as I had never seen it then, even when she was leaving me. But her sadness was resolute, almost wary, and she was entirely attentive, the vivid eyes no longer vague. She revealed her red, slightly swollen hands and clawed ineffectually at her rumpled collar.
"What is there to explain? Why should I?"
"You mean I'm not behaving like a gentleman?"
"No, no.
Look, I must go to the hairdressing lady.
I behaved like a gentleman then, and look where it got me."
"I never pressed you. I believed you when you said you'd marry me. I loved you. I love you."
"All right, you said then that you couldn't trust me. You thought I'd be unfaithful and so on."
"Oh, God!
Perhaps you feel something like that, that you couldn't trust me now. But believe me, there are no women, no one with me. I'm alone, really alone. I want you to know that."
"There's no need to say.
It doesn't matter. Yes, don't misunderstand me. I just want you to know it's simply me. And I'm like I always was, so there's nothing to worry about.
I must go to the hairdresser."
"Hartley, please."
"Oh, all right. Why indeed should you explain?
Do you want me to go away now and never try to see you again?"
Of course, I did not intend her to say yes, and she did not.
"No, I don't want that. I don't know what I want."
The desolate sound of this, the sound of need at last, made me feel much happier and much more clear-headed.
"Hartley, darling, you've got to talk to me, you know you have. After all, there's so much to talk about, isn't there?
I won't do you any harm. My love for you then was mixed up, with all sorts of conflicts which don't exist now. So it can all be better, and we've sort of got it back again after all. Don't you see? We can be real friends. And I do want to get to know your husband."
I then felt bound to add, "I did like him so much, by the way." This rang false. Hartley had hunched herself up again behind the pew.
"Anyway, we must talk. There's so much I want to tell you before it's too late, and I want to ask you hundreds of questions. I don't mean about what happened then. I mean about you, and how you've lived, and about...
Oh, Titus, I'd love to meet him. Perhaps I could help him."
"Help him?"
"Yes, why not? Financially, for instance, or... I know a lot about the world, Hartley. About some worlds, anyway. What does he want to do? What is he studying?"
Hartley gave a deep sigh and then rubbed her cheeks with her red hands. She produced her handkerchief, still stained with lipstick. Tears had risen into her eyes.
"Hartley, dear. He's gone. He ran away. He's lost. We don't know where he is. We haven't heard anything from him for nearly 2 years. He's gone away.
Oh, God." So cunning and vile is the human soul that I felt instantly glad that Hartley had this understandable cause of grief, and had told me about it, and was weeping about it in my presence. Suddenly there was sympathy, communication.
"I'm so sorry."
"But can't he be found? Have you told the police? There are ways of finding people. I could help there." Hartley mopped her face, then took a mirror and powder compact out of her bag and dabbed powder round her eyes. I had seen so many women powder their faces. I was seeing Hartley perform this little ritual of vanity for the first time. She said,
"You can't help, and please don't try to. Better to leave us alone and—"
"Hartley, I'm not going to leave you alone, so you must make up your mind to that and invent some humane way of dealing with me. Are you just afraid of falling in love with me again? Is that it?" She stood up, lifted her shopping basket, which was beside me, and dropped her handbag into it. I came round into her pew and put my arms firmly around her shoulders. It still felt like doing the impossible. For a moment she bowed her head and rolled her brow quickly to and fro against my shirt, and I felt the blazing warmth of her flesh against mine. Then she pushed past me and began to walk to the door. I followed. "When shall I see you?"
"Please don't. You'll worry us. And please don't write."
"Hartley, what is it?"
"Let go. Let yourself love me a bit. There'll be no harm.
Or do you think I'm such a grandee? I'm not, you know. I'm just your oldest friend."
"Don't do anything. I'll write to you later."
"You promise?"
"Yes, I'll write. Only don't come."
"Won't you explain?"
"There's nothing to explain. Stay here, please."
And she went away. Dearest Lizzie, I have been reflecting on what you said in your sweet and wise letter,
and what you said also when we met at the tower. I have to ask your pardon. I think perhaps that you are right after all. I love you, but it may be that my rather, as you say, abstract idea of our being together is not, for either of us, the best expression of that love. We might just create confusion and unhappiness for both. Your suspicions of me may indeed be just, and you are not the first one to express such doubts. Perhaps I am by now too much of a restless Don Juan. So let us play it differently. This is not necessarily a sad conclusion, and we must both be realistic, especially as someone else's happiness is also at stake. I was very touched and impressed by the spectacle of your relationship with Gilbert. It is an achievement and must, of course, be respected. What does it matter what people exactly are to each other, so long as they love and cherish each other and are true to each other? You are so right to emphasize that word. You doubted my capacity to be loyal, and I am near enough to sharing your doubts to be anxious for us not to take the risk. It is just as well that we never defined what we expected. We are both fortunate in being happy as we are, and we can simply count our old affectionate friendship, now so happily revived, as a bonus. We don't want, do we, any more anguish or muddle. You are quite right. I shall respect your wisdom and your wishes, and the rights of my old friend Gilbert. It is, as you said, important that we all three like each other, and let us, as you urged, enjoy a free and unpossessive mutual affection. So please forget my original foolish letter, to which you so bravely and rationally responded, and also my somewhat bullying tactics at our last meeting. I am lucky to have friends such as you and Gilbert, and I intend to treasure them in a sensible, and I hope generous, way. I shall look forward to seeing you soon in London, where I shall be arriving shortly. I will let you know. Accept, both of you, my affectionate best wishes, and, if I may belatedly offer them, my congratulations. Be well, little Lizzie, and remember me. Your old friend, Charles. This was the letter, partly disingenuous, partly sincere, which I wrote to Lizzie on the afternoon of the day when I saw Hartley in the church for the second time. I returned home in a frenzy of misery and indecision, and after a while spent fruitlessly wondering what to do next, I decided that one sensible thing at least which I could do to pass the time would be to get rid of Lizzie. This involved no mental struggle and no problem except the labour of writing a suitable letter, and concentrating upon Lizzie long enough to complete it. How totally, in every atom, I had been changed was shown by the fact that my idea about Lizzie now seemed to me an insane fancy from whose consequences I had been mercifully saved by Lizzie's own common sense, and for this I blessed her. A flame had licked out of the past and burnt up that structure of intentions completely. What had been made clear in the last 2 days, which seemed like months, was how far I had been right in thinking that there was only one real love in my life. It was as if I had in some spiritual sense actually married Hartley long ago, and was simply not free to look elsewhere. Of course I had really known this all along, but on seeing her again the sense of absolute belongingness had been overwhelming. In the teeth of our fate's most exquisite cruelty, in the teeth of all the evidence, we belonged to each other. I did, in fact, manage to think quite intensely about Lizzie while I was writing the letter, and to think of her with a kind of generous, resigned affection. I saw her laughing, radiant face as it had been when she was younger, when we used to laugh so much about her loving me. In spite of the incredible gaucherie of my idea, it was possible that I had quite accidentally acquired Lizzie as a friend whose affection and loyalty might even one day be of value. But now the decks must be cleared. There must be absolutely no problem, no interesting connection involving discussions or letters or visits. I had no time and no strength for any such muddle, and it would be criminal to risk one. My hint about coming to London was, of course, simply a ploy to keep Lizzie there. I could not have endured the arrival of an emotional Lizzie on my doorstep now. There had been a slaughter of all my other interests, and upon the strange, white, open scene of the future, only one thing remained. So let little Lizzie remain safely in storage with Gilbert. I could now even feel benevolent towards him. Was this new, detached generosity, I wondered in passing, a first symptom of that changed and purified form of being which the return of Hartley was going to create in me? Was Hartley seen not touched, loved not possessed, destined to make me a saint? How strange and significant that I had come precisely here to repent of my egoism. Was this perhaps the final sense of my mystical marriage with my only love? It was an extreme idea, but it had its own deep logic, and flourished somewhat upon the absence of alternatives. There was, for me, surely no other move. I was, of course, aware that one point of the extreme idea was that it consoled me with an offer of happiness, though of an extremely refined and attenuated sort. Other prospects, more closely related to the horror of recent events, were less vague and less pleasing, and I had an urgent, dark desire to act, which was not illumined by my aspirations to sanctity. But what could I do? Start looking for Titus? My central question, at least, was now answered. Hartley was unhappy. But this brought forward a further central question. Why was she unhappy? Was it simply because her son had vanished? Or were there other reasons? Why would she not let me help her? Why would she not let me in? Or was it naive to expect confidences from a woman I had not seen for more than 40 years? I had kept her being alive in me, but to her I might simply be a shadow, an almost forgotten schoolboy. I could not believe this. Was she perhaps, on the contrary, still so much in love with me that she dare not trust herself to see me? Did she imagine I had smart, handsome mistresses of whom she would be miserably jealous? What had she been doing down on the sea road, when Rosina's headlights suddenly revealed her to me? Had she come to spy? To find out? She had promised to write. But would she write? And if she did, would she explain? Could I? Was I capable of it? Simply wait. And perhaps wait and wait for that letter. And, obeying her, do nothing? I so intensely wanted to explain myself, to pour out everything I felt and thought, and which, in those miserable, scrappy encounters, I had not managed to say. Should I write her a long letter? If I did, I would certainly not entrust it to the post. That brought me back again to Le Marie. Why was she unhappy? Was it because he was jealous, a tyrant, a bully, who never let anyone come near her? Was that it? And if so, how my mind leapt forward at this thought, and how many lurid vistas and fiery hollows were suddenly opened up. At the same time I knew that sanity and a faithfulness to Hartley, which must be kept untainted, forbade this kind of speculation. I had no heart to cook lunch. I fried an egg, but could not eat it. I drank some of the young Beaujolais which had been delivered from the Raven Hotel. I found the wine, Beaujolais and some Spanish stuff, outside the door when I got back from the village. Then I occupied myself by writing the letter to Lizzie, which I have copied out above. After that I thought it might do my soul some good if I went swimming. The tide was in, and the sea was very calm and clearer than usual. Looking down from my cliff before I dived in, I could see tall, dark trees of seaweed gently waving, and fishes swimming between them. I swam about quietly, looking at that special swimmer's view of the sea, and feeling, for the time, possessing and possessed. The sea was a glassy, slightly heaving plain, moving slowly past me, and as if it were shrugging reflectively as it absent-mindedly supported its devotee. Some large seagulls with the yellowest conceivable beaks gathered to watch me. I felt no anxiety about getting out, and when I swam back to my cliff face, I was able quite easily to cling on to my handholds and footholds and pull myself up out of the water. In fact, the little cliff is not in itself very hard to climb. It is just that, as I explained, if one is being constantly lifted up and abruptly dropped again by the movement of the waves, it is impossible to keep one's fingers and toes in place long enough to get a proper grip. When I was in the sea, I thought to myself how little it mattered to me that Hartley was no longer beautiful. This seemed a good thought, and I held on to it, and it brought me, together with tenderness, a little calm. After that I stupidly sat in the sun, but it was too hot, and my immersion had after all brought me little wisdom. Perhaps I had not been wrong in thinking of the sea as a source of peace.
but it was an ineffective medicine thus taken in a gulp. It required a regime. I walked about, scorching my feet and looking into one or two of my pools, but the pleasure had departed, and I could no longer concentrate upon those brilliant, lucid little civilizations, although in the strong light the coloured pebbles and the miniature seaweed trees looked like jewels by Fabergé. I watched a dance of prawns, and the progress of a green, transparent sea slug, and saw again the long, coiling red worm which had somehow reminded me of my sea serpent. Then I noticed, to my annoyance, some tourists from, I suppose, the Raven Hotel, who were actually standing on my land and inspecting the tower. I went into the house with burning shoulders and a splitting headache. It was now obvious that I would soon have to do something, to perform some ritual act which would relate to my situation and perhaps alter it. What I wanted to do, of course, was to run straight to Hartley. I had not even kissed her yet. How timid and feeble I had been this morning in the church. But I would have, ingeniously, to find some substitute for this headlong rush. Like the deprived addict, I found ordinary diversions useless. Everything I did now had to relate to the one world centre. I decided, just in order to keep moving, to walk down to the village and post the letter to Lizzie. Of course I hoped to see Hartley, but I did not really imagine that I would. It was now late afternoon, the kind of vivid light which would have made me want to shout with joy a little while ago. When I had crossed the causeway, I saw some letters lying in my dog kennel, and I picked them up. One of them was from Lizzie. I tore it open and read it as I walked along. "My darling, of course the answer will have to be yes. My fears were foolish and unworthy. Please forgive my confused response to your wonderful offer. I am your page, as I always was, and shall I not come to you if, even for a moment, you need me? I haven't said anything to Gilbert yet, and I don't know how to. When we meet, will you please be gentle and help me about this? I can't just abandon him. There must be some way of not hurting him too much. Please understand. And let me see you soon. I want to say so many things. Shall I come to you, or will you be in London? I wish I could telephone you. Don't ring here because of Gilbert. By the way, I told Gilbert I was writing to you because he asked, and he says, will you have dinner with us here Monday of next week if you're in town? I pass this on, but I imagine in the circumstances you won't want to. I love you so much, Lizzie. I'm so frightened that you are angry with me. Please reassure me soon. I sighed over this rather shifty missive, which gave me so little pleasure. What was this offer I was supposed to have made her? She almost made it seem as if she was endeavouring to oblige me. I noted that she had not yet told Gilbert and showed no signs of leaving him, but I felt no urge to reflect upon the state of Lizzie's mind. It did not matter now. I hastened my steps and reached the post office just before it closed. I posted my letter to Lizzie and sent her a telegram which ran as follows. Your first idea was right. See my letter which crossed with yours. In London soon, and gratefully accept dine you and Gilbert. Love, Charles. That should make the situation sufficiently clear, and also keep Lizzie in London. I had, of course, no intention of dining with them, and would send a cancellation at the last moment. I emerged into the street, where it was still sunny, and the evening light was making even the slates of the roofs cast little shadows, and the whitewashed walls were silver gilt. I walked up to the church and looked inside. It was empty and already in shadow, and full of the smell of the roses, which were a white blur in the hazy, dusty air. I came out into the light and spent some time looking at the various sailing ships on the tombstones, which the slanting illumination had brought out in strong relief. Walking back down the street, it occurred to me that the Black Lion was open, and I went in. There was the usual sudden hush.
"Seen any more ghosts?" said Arkwright, as he served me with cider. "No."
"Wasn't you asking about big eels?" said someone else. "Seen any?"
"No."
"Seen any seals?"
"No. He ain't seen nothing."
A titter. I was feeling hungry, so I ate a cheese sandwich and a horrible pork pie. I sat for a while and looked at the rest of my mail. I did not care a fig for the company, and I did not mind if they knew it. The letters sent on by Miss Kaufman were all personal, but of little interest.
They included one which would formerly have pleased me from Sidney Ash, describing comical goings-on in Stratford, Ontario. There was also one from my physicist friend, previously mentioned, I think, Victor Banstead of Cambridge. I crumpled all the letters up, including Liz's, and dropped them into a nearby basket, and then had to scrabble in it, under the amused gaze of the company, to get them out again. I crammed them in my pocket and said good night. No one answered. Once I had closed the door, there was prolonged